I guess few could doubt the impact of the Bethlehem baby. It's a birth that divides our history. We date events before it and after it. It's a birth that shaped our society. Christian influence started schools and hospitals. But it's a birth that dominates our calendar. Santa was grottoing in Debenhams in September. Christmas lights on in November. The day itself in December, a mixture of Christmas turkey and Christmas television, of Christmas presents and Christmas pudding. December the 25th dominates the diary. And then January, gifts to exchange, the tree to dismantle, and Barclay card to pay. Christmas makes its own impact on all of us. And yet the Christian claim is that take away the trappings, unwrap Christmas, and you'll find at the centre a baby born in Bethlehem. Which makes the recorded details of a birth of such importance somewhat surprising. For in Matthew's account, it's printed out on the back of the service order. You might like to cast your eye at it. In Matthew's account of this birth, let me read again to you the details he gives us of just the birth. Sentence 25. Joseph had no union with her, that's Mary, until she gave birth to a son. That is the sum total of Matthew's interest in the facts of the birth. She gave birth to a son. And you could say that of any mother giving birth to a baby boy. She gave birth to a son. Or we could say it of a number of wives in our family of St. Helens this year. Harriet, she gave birth to a son. The fact of the birth is recorded as just that, a fact. There are no details about the length of labour, the weight of the child, the comfort of the mother. So is Matthew being cold and unromantic about birth? No. It's just that in his carefully ordered and selective account, Matthew recorded not the details of the birth, but the significance of the birth. For sandwiched either side of this fact of birth, Matthew places incidents that point us to why this birth should have any impact on us at all. And notice with me first the names he receives, the name he receives. Because you'll see that straight after the fact of the birth comes the naming of the baby. Joseph gives him the name Jesus. But he only did that because an angel had earlier told him to do so. Sentence 20. Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. Joseph was following divine command. He and Mary didn't have to visit Smith's and buy the what shall we call the baby book. Yeah, there was no autumn evenings leafing through the names. Abraham, Adam, Artaxerxes. Now, you will give him the name Jesus, says the angel. But the name is given by God not to spare Joseph and Mary the decision, but given the name that will signify what he will do. And that's something that none of us could have done. You see, an ultrasound scan may determine the gender of a fetus, but not even modern medicine can tell the future work of a baby. Could any of us affirm with confidence what our children will do in adulthood, such that even before they're born, we could write to Somerset House and register the child's name appropriately? The husband and wife, before their child arrives, decide to call him or her brain surgeon, or Chancellor of the Exchequer, or footballer. But here God provided the name because it's already been decided what this child will do. His future is already mapped out. Look at sentence 21. You will give him the name Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. What's in a name? In this case, everything. Because it signifies the whole purpose of God by his Spirit causing an ordinary engaged girl to become pregnant. Hey, sure, this name, Jesus per se, wasn't an unknown name. It's the Greek form of an Old Testament name, an Old Testament hero, in fact, Joshua. And so some indeed did call their children after him. You know, just as a couple of years ago, people seemed to call their children Jason and Kylie. Or I suppose today it might be Gaza. Well, the name Jesus means the Lord saves, but the Bethlehem baby is given that name because that is exactly what he will do. Exactly what he is being sent into the world to do, to save people from their sins. Oh, the word save just means rescue. The baby is born to be a rescuer. But rescue always has to be from something. I remember my attractive sister struggling out of her depth in a swimming pool. And a handsome, tanned, bronzed Australian, seeing the danger, plunged in to save my drowning sister, aged 5. Rescued from drowning. I suppose you might say a company may be rescued from bankruptcy. Or the Americans rescuing Somalians from starvation. Rescue from something. And it's no different here with this rescuer. The angel explains what the rescue will be from. He will save or rescue people from their sins. The disaster he's come to rescue us from is spiritual. It's a sin problem that he's come to save us from. Save from sin. Now, for many of us, sin will be a misunderstood word because some limit it to just serious crime, others to obviously immoral behaviour. But that is to take a blinkered view. The Bible sees sin as a universal condition of us all, something that we're all contaminated with. Because sin, in essence, is rebellion against God. It's placing ourselves as more important than God. It's placing our ways above his ways. And we need rescue from this sin because there's a price tag attached to sin. Justice attached to wrongdoing. Punishment attached to rebellion. The Bible's view is that one day sin must be paid for. Wrongdoing must receive justice. Rebellion must be punished. And that's why humankind needs rescue. Rescue from sin. And that's what this baby will do. For read on in Matthew's account, and you'll see how he achieved what his name anticipates. Indeed, if we don't ever read from Christmas to Easter, from crib to cross, from birth to death, then we'll only ever have a Christmas card, Christianity. For a Christmas can't show the significance of this birth. If it's a Christian Christmas card at all, and not just one of those robins playing in the snow, then the best it can do is capture the fact of Christmas. Oh, it usually dresses it up a little, so there's a hygienic stable, as hygienic as an operating theatre. The donkey looks as if he's on holiday from Clacton, and the hay looks as if it's been washed and tumble-dried. But deny the birth, he's heading towards the cross, and the fact of the birth is robbed of any significance. The baby was born to die, in death to pay the price for our sin, in death to receive justice for our wrongdoing, in death to bear punishment for our rebellion. You see, a just God couldn't just turn a blind eye to our sin, couldn't sweep it under the carpet, concoct a cover-up and say it never happened. No, he will rescue from sin, literally save us from what we deserve by his death substituting for our death. His death should be our death, so that we might be rescued, spared, saved from an eternal spiritual death. The name he receives, Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. One poet puts it like this: if our greatest need had been information, God would have sent us an educator. If our greatest need had been money, God would have sent us an economist. If our greatest need had been technology, God would have sent us a scientist. If our greatest need had been pleasure, God would have sent us an entertainer. But our greatest need was forgiveness. So God sent us a saviour. Rescue from sin. But Matthew also wants in this account to show us that this rescue is by God. In other words, not just what this baby will do, but who this baby is. The identity of the child as well as the work of the child. Look at sentence 22. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. For here we see a second title given to Jesus. Not a name given him by Joseph, but a title to be declared to him by the people. They will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. In other words, people will declare this baby to be none other than God. 700 years earlier, the prophet Isaiah anticipated not just that rescue would come, but the identity of the rescuer, Emmanuel, God with us. Or in words made popular by Handel in The Messiah, which I'll read rather than sing, unto us a son is given, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Titles in the Old Testament ascribed only to God. In other words, it's God to the rescue. It makes Christmas all the more staggering, doesn't it? That the Creator should be born as one created. But it had to be God to the rescue. It had to be him come as rescuer, because no one else could do it. And no other mere human could rescue me from sin when they're contaminated with sin themselves. The drowning must be rescued by a swimmer. The bankrupt rescued by the solvent. And so the sinner must be rescued by the sinless. The guilty rescued by the innocent. God's own son had to step in, step down, and do it himself. God with us. We see something of the significance of this birth by the name he receives. But notice with me, secondly, we see something of the significance of this birth by the visitors he receives. Before the fact of the birth, we're told the name he will receive. After the fact of the birth, we see the visitors he receives. And no mention of the in-laws, no mention of the Bethlehem district midwife, but instead the famous story read to us of the visitors from the east. A group of foreign stargazers, EastEnders. It's legend that tells us that they were wise. It's legend that tells us they were three. It's legend that tells us their names were Melchior, Gaspar and Balthazar. And their story isn't included to give bit parts to every primary school teacher for the nativity play, or to give Sky TV an advertising slogan, follow the stars. Now the important thing that Matthew wants us to grasp is that the first people to come and acknowledge Jesus as Messiah are foreigners, not Jews. Matthew wants us to see right from the outset who this Jesus is for. You see, contrary to first century expectations that the Messiah would be for just the Jews, now Matthew wants us to show us that it's for everybody. And so right through his gospel account, Matthew emphasizes the inclusion in the rescue of the non-Jew. So Jesus' first visitors here, as we've read, are non-Jews. Jesus' first hearers in his gospel are non-Jews. The first commendation of faith by Jesus is to a non-Jew. The rescue is not limited to the inhabitants of a few hundred square miles of Palestinian soil. No, this is an international rescue. The risen Jesus at the end of this gospel commissions his disciples to take the news of rescue to the ends of the earth. to all nations. And no racial prejudice, no spiritual apartheid. One commentator declared this summer's Olympic Games as the only thing that embraced every country of the world. And Matthew wants us to see that it's this good news of rescue that in fact does that. And if it's for the world, then it's for us, whoever we are here tonight. And notice the name he receives and the visitors he receives, and we notice what a Christmas card can never show, the significance of the birth. It's that that Matthew focuses our attention on. Rescue from sin, rescue by God, and rescue for all. But as we come to a close, notice also in the account of these visitors that Matthew gives us a picture of how the rescue is received. For a response is to be made to this baby, a response that's seen clearly in the contrast between Herod and the visitors. The contrast is seen clearly in the response to what God reveals to them. To both, revelation from God is given. The Magi follow the revelation from God in the star, and they follow it to what right where Jesus is lying. In marked contrast to Herod. Oh, he too is given revelation from God. He knows where the Messiah will be born. His advisers, his chief priests, his Old Testament scholars could look up Old Testament prophecies and see that it would be Bethlehem. But Herod, in contrast to the Magi, never, never leaves Jerusalem. But not just a contrast in response to what God shows them, but a striking contrast in response to the baby himself. The EastEnders, they bow before the baby in worship. They acknowledge him to be king and to be Lord. In contrast to Herod, who's threatened by this Jesus, born a king, and so he hatches a murder plot to be rid of him. Here in infancy we see that Jesus divides between those who follow the evidence and therefore accept this baby as king and worship him, and those who have the evidence but won't follow it, and who live in practice as if this baby didn't exist. At his birth, we see the contrast, the division that continues even until today, between those on the one hand who accept this Jesus and those who will reject him, between those who submit to him as king and those who continue to rebel against it. It's the contrast between those who accept rescue and those who reject it. Rescue, not forced on anyone, but offered to everyone. And it's worth remembering that rejecting rescue is dangerous. Imagine for a moment the drowning swimmer who rejects the hand of the lifeguard. Or imagine the starving person who rejects the food of the aid worker. Well, so imagine the judged sinner who rejects the forgiveness of the rescuer God. The choice is ours to make, to mirror Herod or to copy the Magi, reject or accept, rebel or submit, kill or worship. The fact of Jesus' birth, Matthew tells with rapidity. It's the significance he wants us to see. Rescue from sin, rescue by God, rescue for all. But rescue received? Or rescue rejected? We began our carol service by singing the words, "O come, let us adore him." The first stable visitors did just that. It would be worthwhile us pausing sometime this Christmas and ask ourselves whether it'll be for us the rejection of a Herod or the adoration of the Magi.